So this morning, we're going to take a walk through the Beatitudes. This is something that we've been going through in senior youth together. So I thought I'd bring you up to speed where we are at. Imagine for a moment that you are gathered on a hillside. You're there with all your friends, and you're waiting for Jesus to begin speaking. He's been teaching all week, and you're looking forward to what he has to say. He comes up to the mountainside, and he sits down, and he starts talking. And as a member of the audience, you're really not sure what you're going to hear. But it's bound to be encouraging. I mean, it's Jesus, after all, right? He encourages people. Maybe he'll take the opportunity just to notice how good of a job I'm doing. Maybe he'll take the opportunity just to be happy that I showed up. The crowd that gathered to hear Jesus speak was diverse. There was probably some religious leaders, some bystanders, just some people walking by. They sat up on the hillside waiting for Jesus to speak, maybe expecting praise for what they've been doing. One thing's for certain, that the crowd probably didn't expect the length of the sermon that Jesus was about to go into. We get restless sitting through a 30-minute sermon, and I can't imagine sitting through the length of the sermon that Jesus was going through on that day. As I said before, over the past few weeks, we've been going through this sermon and through the Beatitudes, which are at the start of the Sermon on the Mount. The word beatitude comes from the Latin word beatus, which means blessed. And the Beatitudes come right at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, and it's intended to be this way. These aren't just random words that come together, random things that Jesus is talking about, but there's a purpose to it. In the Beatitudes, we have what would probably be the equivalent of 8-9 different sermons where you could speak individually on each and every different verse. But I want to take this moment, and I want to talk about the larger context of the verse, the whole section in the greater context. We get in trouble sometimes when we pull just little portions out, especially when it relates to the Sermon on the Mount. We can just take out a verse, and we can just apply it to what we want, but sometimes we get in trouble when we do that. So we want to look at the context of the greater Beatitudes this morning. And it's really important to understand the flow of the Beatitudes, because there is a flow. These, like I said before, these aren't just random words that Jesus is speaking here. And what Jesus is getting across here, what he's pointing out, is this is against the norm, right? Culture has one way to expect things, and Jesus is saying here that he expects different things, to go beyond the norm. While the world praises wealth, condemns poverty, Jesus embraces it, because of dependence on him. In meekness, we see the world sees a footstool, right? I'll talk later about what meekness means. But Jesus sees people who are capable of relying on him and capable of remarkable things. For many who came to hear Jesus speak on this day, they came there with their cup full. This is what their cup looked like. I used iced tea just as a little bit of an experiment. But this is what their cup looked like. It's full. It's dingy. It's dark. And this represents our lives. Right? We come to God, and this is what our life looks like. Sometimes what our lives look like. There's not a whole lot of room in there for God. So we come to him, and we ask him to kind of fit in that cup. It doesn't always work that way. God simply doesn't just want a little bit of space in your life. He doesn't want just simply a little bit of wiggle room. He wants your entire life. Jesus says this, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." What on earth does this mean? I can only imagine there's a crowd was sitting there, wealthy people, they're thinking, no, he got this wrong, right? He wants to encourage the rich people, right? The rich people are useful, right? The rich people have money. The rich people can do things. But he's talking about he's encouraging the poor people, right? Is he encouraging poverty? This just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Poor people are useless, right? They're not capable of anything. Why on earth would Jesus bless the poor people? What does it mean to be poor in spirit? It's not a weakness. It's not a doormat. It's not thinking less of yourself. And it's not just even intentionally just being poor for the sake of being poor. To be poor in spirit, it's not about what you have or don't have. It's about who comes first in your life. The only way we can be poor in spirit is to truly believe that Jesus is more valuable than anything we could have or even could possess. Matthew 5:3 says this in the Message. The same verse says, "You're blessed when you're at the end of your rope. With less of you, there is more of God and His rule." God has special favor for those who are poor in spirit because they bring nothing to the table. Right? They bring nothing to the table. It's not what they don't have. It's not that they don't have anything to offer or any value, but their value is seen in God. God sees their value, and He loves that they depend on Him for everything. Poor in spirit is all about an attitude change, right? If we come to God in our pride and in our esteem, and we say, "God, this is me, right? You can't change me. This is who I am." How do we expect God to work in that? When we come in an impoverished attitude and just poor in our spirit, God is going to do remarkable things. Like I said before, it's not just intentionally being poor. I mean, money we can throw away. People can live in poverty. And we can't expect God to just simply be working in us just in a state of lack of wealth. It's a selfless attitude that puts God first. How do we develop this attitude, you might ask? James 4:7-10 is a perfect way to develop this attitude. It says this: "Submit yourselves then to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Come near to God, and he will come near to you. Wash your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. Grieve, mourn, and wail. Change your laughter to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will lift you up." Humble submission to God. Resist the devil's plans. Come near to God. The world sees values in richness and wealth. None of that impresses God. God is pleased with empty vessels. People who come to Him empty, wanting Him to fill them up. He wants clay that He can mold. He doesn't desire for people to come to them in perfection. When we realize the poverty of our spirit and we come humbly before God, suddenly there is a little bit of room in our lives. In verse 4, Jesus says, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." Naturally, when we think of this verse, we think of people who are mourning, right? People who've lost loved ones. And that's a natural way to think about it. But Jesus desires for us to go a little bit deeper. Don't get me wrong, I'm certain, I know for a fact that God comforts those who are mourning. I know for a fact that God comes alongside those who've lost a loved one and comforts them. Our relationship with God goes so much deeper than any earthly relationship. When we mourn over loss, the pain we mostly feel is separation. What Jesus is getting at here is the separation between you and God is a much bigger problem. What he's saying is that you are blessed when you mourn over the sin in your life. When you see that the sin in your life is separating you and God. When you come to the point when you realize that your sin is causing separation between you and God, we have to mourn over that. That's a big deal. If sin goes past a rule or a guideline to a separation of relationship, then we see the greater problem. A great example of this is found in Psalm 51. And this is David's kind of cry out, lament, cry out to God. And David's heart is troubled after what happened with Bathsheba and the death of her husband. And instead of making excuses, he recognizes his sin in verse 4, and he recognizes it. He says, "Against you, Lord, only you have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight." His sin is obvious. His sin had hurt other people, but he was more concerned about the fact that his sin was coming between him and God. That was the bigger deal. No excuses, no rationalizing, no passing the blame, just acceptance. In my life, and maybe some of you have this in your own life, we make up excuses for our sin, right? All of a sudden, it's everybody else's fault that I have sin in my life, right? We pass the buck. It's the fault of the guy in the gray truck, right? He cut me off, right? It was his fault that I swore at him, right? It's the girl's fault for making me sin, right? How dare she walk in front of me looking all cute and that? Others may have been there to impact on what happened, but I have to take responsibility for my sin. Why do we need to mourn over sin? Because we need to change. I don't know about some of you, but when I grew up, I had this one sin that I kept coming back to God with. I struggled with swearing. Every night, I would come back to God and I would say, God, I'm sick of this. I'm sick of this. I want to stop swearing. Only to the next day, I'd be using all kind of language, and I just, you know, I had this constant cycle where I would come back to God and I'd say, God, take this from me. And the moment he would take it from me, and I would come back a few minutes later and be swearing again. And then I'd come back to God. And it was just cycle after cycle after cycle. And finally, it just clicked in me. I'm not really feeling bad for what I'm doing, right? I'm coming to God, and I'm just asking him to excuse what I'm doing, right? I don't feel bad that I'm hurting God. I feel bad that I'm swearing, but this is not between me and God. This is just between me and swearing, right? And then all of a sudden, as I got a little bit older, it clicked in me. What I'm doing is hurting God. That's why we need to mourn over sin. When I break God's heart, it hurts him and it hurts our relationship. Our sin separates us to God. When we realize this, there is suddenly a little more room in the cup. Thirdly, Jesus offers blessing to the meek. Meekness is one of those terms that a lot of us confuse. We struggle to understand. In the world's eyes, they see meekness as a doormat, right? Spineless, weak, gutless, passive, timid. Basically, you could take just about any understanding you have and throw it out the window because it's probably wrong. I had to chuckle because there's actually a group online. They are called the Dependent Order of Really Meek and Timid Souls, and here's their slogan. The meek shall inherit the earth if it's okay with everyone else. I've seen some people who actually think that meekness is this. They go to a restaurant, they order a Coke, they get a root beer, but they won't complain because that's unchristlike. That's not meekness. That is not an interpretation of meekness. Meekness is power under control. To give you an example here, think of a horse. I'm not a horse lover. My wife is a horse lover. They have so much power and so much ability on their own. An unbroken horse can be extremely dangerous. But a horse under control can do some pretty amazing things. On our own, just like the horse, we can be fairly wild, and we can hurt a lot of people. But under God's power, we yield our power over to him. It's not that we're powerless. It's not that we're weak. We just use our power under him. It's not denying your power, but rather instead using it for God's glory. Here's a really awesome quote from A.W. Tozer on meekness. The meek man is not a human mouse afflicted with a sense of his own inferiority. Rather, he may be in his moral life as bold as a lion and as strong as Samson, but he has stopped being fooled about himself. He has accepted God's estimate for his life. He knows he is a weak and helpless as God declared him to be. But paradoxically, he knows at the same time that he is in the sight of God more important than the angels. In himself, nothing. In God, everything. That is his motto. If our attitude reflects these three beatitudes, we are left with an empty cup. Now the cup is empty. At the start, when we came, it was full of everything that I brought, right? It was full of my pride, full of my arrogance, and there wasn't a whole lot of room for God. But as I empty it out, all of a sudden, there is room for God to work. It's at this point where that cup is empty, and it's our choice now how we're going to fill that up. And that's where the cool part of the Beatitudes come in here. Does Jesus just simply stop there? Does he just say, blessed are the meek, and then that's it? No. At this point, he starts to fill us back up. Verse 6, this is where the cup starts to be refilled. Do we desire to refill our lives with the old garbage? Do we desire to just pour that back in and go back to God in our pride and just say, you know what? This is me, God. I'm prideful. Give God no room and just expect him to do things. I think of this a lot about the way that, you know, we eat. Every 3 to 4 hours we get hungry, and this is our daily routine. We come back to God and we eat, and then we're full for a few minutes. And then we come back to God we eat, and we're full for a few minutes. Life is full of a lot of temporary things that we're going to fill our cups up with that are really not going to satisfy us. A couple years ago, I had this obsession with getting a flat screen TV. Everybody had a flat screen TV. And I thought, only if I could have a flat screen TV would my life be made, right? Life would be complete when I had a flat screen TV. So what did I do? I went to the store. I saved up some money, went to the store, and I bought a flat screen TV, right? I got home for about 2 hours, and I was like, this is awesome, you know? Like, oh, this is amazing. Like, this is TV, right? Before it was not TV, now this is TV. And then all of a sudden it hit me. I'm like, why is my picture so fuzzy? Well, I don't have an HD signal, right? So all of a sudden, this temporary fill left me with nothing, right? Now I needed my Xbox. Now I needed an HD receiver. Now I needed this. And the list keeps going on and on and on. And I keep trying to find these temporary fillers to make me happy when my filler and what I need is right here. These temporary fillers seem pretty good initially, but they just leave us desiring more. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, Jesus says, for they will be filled. And this is the point where they fill the cup back up. And suddenly, now my cup is full, but it's full with God. He has the room. He is the only one in there. For the crowd that was talking, was sitting with Jesus, they knew what it meant to be hungry. We don't understand hunger, right? We don't understand what it means to physically go days and days and days and days without being hungry, right? These people understood famine. They understood fighting for food, right? We don't understand that. No McDonald's, no Dairy Queen, no microwave. You can bet eating to excess probably didn't happen. Jesus acknowledged their hunger and desired to feed them a meal where they would never go hungry. A man who hungers and thirsts for righteousness with God will be fed and will be filled. Often the focus is to care for physically our own selves, right? Our physical selves, to eat and then to add God on top. Jesus says, no, that's not the way it works. You fill up with me and then food comes later. It seems kind of radical thinking, but it makes sense. Fill up on God first, and then all those other things can come later, right? Those temporary things that only make us happy for a few minutes. Jesus acknowledged their desire for hunger, and he wanted to feed them a meal where they would never hunger again. Jesus felt this firsthand as he was facing the devil in Matthew chapter 4. And he says this, man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. And we have the choice. What are we going to fill our cup up with? We're going to fill it with our own things, our own agenda, our own desires. The very act of hunger makes us want something, right? I've seen teenage men literally run over their mothers to get food in the act of being hungry, right? And as we fill ourselves up with God, if we fill ourselves up with God, all of a sudden, if I was to fill this cup even more, it would overflow, right? And that overflow comes in the form of mercy. That's what Jesus gets to next here. Mercy is built on the Hebrew concept of hesed, or loving kindness. In the Old Testament, God's hesed was his covenant-keeping love despite people failing him, he still loved them. And the fact that God loves wayward people so tenderly gives us insight into his mercy. We see mercy in action in Luke chapter 10, verse 25. Probably many of you are very familiar with it. It's the story of the Good Samaritan. This conversation leads Jesus to tell a man to prove the point of loving God first, right? And secondly, to love your neighbor secondly. This Jewish man was left on the side road, beaten. Suddenly this priest comes along, and if you read the scripture, it says he sees him, and he literally takes a path around him, right? The one man that you would expect to help doesn't. He sees him and he walks around him. A couple of minutes later, some time later, a Levite sees him. Maybe he's going to help him. He sees him and he deliberately walks around him. The third man to come by is a Samaritan. As you know, Jews and Samaritans didn't get along very well together. This is the last man that you would expect to help him, but he comes and he helps him. He gives him first aid, he puts bandages on him, and it doesn't just stop there, right? Sometimes we think mercy is just, okay, well, I'll pray for him and it'll all be good, right? Mercy goes further than that. He helps him out. He bandages him. He puts him on his own donkey, he takes him to the local town, and he puts him up at a hotel, right? Sometimes mercy can be inconvenient, right? We have to go out of our way sometimes to show mercy. Sometimes it can be, well, I just really wanted to stop just to make sure you were okay. Well, could you give me a lift to town? Well, I'm not really going that way. Well, sometimes mercy is inconvenient. Is mercy solely for Christians? No. Christians don't have the precedent in mercy. There are amazing people who don't know Jesus who show mercy. The Red Cross, for example, is an agency that shows great mercy. That's their mission, right? So what's different? What's different between my, you know, as a Christian, what's different between my mercy and those who don't know Jesus? I'd like to think that we are guided by God as we show mercy, right? We are led to do things that He leads us to do. And maybe, just maybe, we might show mercy to someone who doesn't necessarily deserve mercy. And I know sometimes we come to God and we say, you know what, God, I'll back up here just a second. And a quick glance at this verse will suggest that if I show mercy, that I'm entitled to get mercy, right? Doesn't work that way, right? Two weeks ago, Derek Neufeld was up here and he was talking about the fact that God doesn't owe us anything, right? We are not his debtor. Doesn't matter how much mercy I show to people, God doesn't owe me anymore. The very fact that I am up here, standing, breathing, walking, living, God has lavished me in mercy, right? He owes me no more mercy. And I, in tune, feel a responsibility. I'm not required to show mercy, but I feel a responsibility to love my neighbor. Why? Because God has loved me and shown me mercy. Jesus moves on here to say, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God." To be pure in heart is to have a heart that has no deceit or falsehood. We see this in verse Psalm 24, that the earth is Lord's and everything in it, and the world and all who live in it, for founded it on the seas and established it on the waters. Who may ascend the mountain of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place? The one who has clean hands and a pure heart. As David says, a pure heart is without deceit. And here's a really cool quote from John Piper. He says this: "The heart is utterly crucial to Jesus. What we are in the deep private recesses of our lives is what he cares about the most. Outward appearance is one thing. God cares so much about your heart. We can't lie to God with our heart, right? He sees our heart. He sees our genuineness in our heart. Outward appearance, we can fool people, but God sees our heart. Even if our society tried to achieve moral purity, to try to look good on the outside, they're still without God, right? We have God, and we can be pure in that. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. If you are a son of God, then you are a peacemaker. No choice. That's how it is. If you are a son of God, you are a peacemaker. Peacemaking goes way beyond our little lives. It's not just creating peace in your marriage. This is like worldwide peace. We live in a world of conflict, and it doesn't take much to turn on the news to see conflict. We see this verse actually continue on later in Matthew 5. In 43 to 45, it says this: "You've heard what it said, love your neighbor, hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you, that they may be children of your Father in heaven." As Christians, are we called to contribute to the decay of this world? No. We're called to preserve, right? We're called to be salt and light. And I know many of us have our own issues and our own things about pacifism. Some of you are for it, some are against it. But when the world retaliates with hate, we need to respond with love. Mennonites traditionally have stood out because of their stance on pacifism. We're not talking about defense. What we are is we're talking about standing out from the crowd, right? Not blending in. Instead of going with the flow, we're to go against it. Instead of doing what the world expects, we stand out from it. Jesus gives us the best solution that we can possibly do to respond to provide peace. Verse 44 and 45, he says, pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. And I don't want to go on too big of a rant here, but when we talk about peacemaking, we can't help but talk about conflict. And like sometimes the struggle that we have as we deal with pacifism is that we struggle how to understand conflict, right? Avoiding conflict is not pacifism, right? Being a peacemaker is not avoiding conflict. Conflict is in this world. It's how we deal with it that makes us peacemakers. We need to deal with it appropriately. We unfortunately see the results of avoiding conflict in our very church. We see it. We see avoidance of conflict, and it manifests itself. And suddenly, when we deal with conflict, it's uncomfortable, right? But unity happens over that. A couple of moments of uncomfort, but unity happens out of it. If conflict is dealt with appropriately, we see it in our marriages, if we deal with conflict properly. I've had conflicts with my wife before. I have. And when I come to her and we deal with the conflict, I love her so much more after that. And I'm sure some of you have probably seen that in your marriages as well too. Why can't we have that in the church? If we are truly pouring out our life and filling up with God, we will be persecuted, right? This is not an option. If you are not being persecuted, maybe you consider yourself blessed. Dare I say, maybe we should wonder why things aren't happening. 2 Timothy 3:12 says this, in fact, everyone who wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. Why is it a blessing to be persecuted? Because we connect with Jesus. We have this amazing connecting with Jesus, who in fact was persecuted himself. As Matthew 5:12 says, rejoice and be glad, great is your reward in heaven. There are countless people ahead of us who've gone before us who have been persecuted. Think of all the things that Paul went through, his time in jail, all of his persecution, and all that he did in his persecution. He wrote letters in jail. He loved people in jail. He actually found that it was actually more benefit to him, to his Christian walk, to be in jail. He found his witness to be better, which is incredible. The lifestyle that Jesus is looking for, and I'll wrap it up here really quickly. The lifestyle that Jesus is looking for here is a changed attitude, right? Not just filling the cup back up with you. A changed attitude. He doesn't just want poor people. He wants people who are poor in the Spirit of God. If you are living in such a way to be poor in the Spirit, you will be blessed. So the choice is yours. Do we wish to fill our cup back up with everything that we want, our agenda, our own things, or do we want to empty it out and fill it back up with God? And I know that when I fill my life up with God, that He is able to do immeasurably more than I can ever ask or imagine. And when we fill our lives up with Him, we will be called a son and daughter of God. It's a promise.